This is Jason Albert, and you are listening to the Faster Skeeter Podcast. In this episode, we sit down with U.S. Ski Team head coach Chris Grover, who is in town for the team's recent May training camp in Bend, Oregon. First off, a small editing note. We recorded the interview in a team condo, and off and on during the interview, you'll hear a bit of chatter in the background. Okay, there's the disclaimer. On to the first question, in which we talk team budget. How has the U.S. Ski Team budget evolved in terms of helping support B and D team level athletes?
When we really got to a point as an organization where we figured out that we could no longer afford to pay everything for, say, a B team level athlete or a D team level athlete, which we were for a number of years before that. As a national team, we had those resources for a few years. Not for very long, but for a few years, we had that kind of reach at a time when we had a smaller team also. But when we had that kind of reach and we came to that point where we figured out we can no longer afford to do everything, we were really scared because we didn't know how it would play out for these athletes who had to go out and raise their own money for their travel and room and board. But it's been amazing to watch what happened, because simultaneously you had the Drive for 25, the NNF step up and start being able to fill the gap for these guys. And you had so many like home club resources and fundraising mechanisms around these athletes begin to develop. And so you have a situation now where we have, you know, there are resources for these guys and they don't have to raise a lot of money out of pocket, because there are clubs and there are fundraising organizations that have sprung up to fill the gap. It's an easy rallying point for communities because they say, hey, we got this athlete, they're on the B team of the U.S. Ski Team, they don't have the funding that they need to get to World Cup. People can visualize that and get behind it and make it happen. So it was like a source of stress at first, and now it's a necessity, but at the same time it's doable. And I think everybody sees that, and it's not the hurdle that we thought it was going to be.
How have you tried to decrease some of the stress on the athletes racing the World Cup, in particular team members that are not fully funded?
Simultaneously, what we've done at the national team level is we've been able to increase the infrastructure that we build around all athletes on the team, whatever their designation is. If you go back 4 or 5 years ago, we might have only had 2 to 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks of PT coverage on the World Cup during the competition season. And now we're at a point where we have PT coverage continuously on the World Cup season. And that's because we've been able to use funding to support all athletes all year to build out the infrastructure. Similarly, you had a situation where if you go back 4 or 5 years ago, we might have had 2 World Cup wax technicians. Or 3 World Cup wax technicians and coaches basically as full-time wax technicians as well. And still we were getting massively outclassed by the bigger nations on the World Cup, most nations and middle-sized nations on the World Cup. Now we're at a point where we have 5 full-time World Cup technicians in the winter, and coaches still helping out because we're still trying to get up there. But we've been able to kind of systematically build the infrastructure around these guys. And of course, you're going to see a wax truck come in the next 14 months for the USA. So it's a continuous building of a support network for these guys that benefits all athletes. You know, going forward, we're probably always going to have a model where athletes need to provide some funding for themselves, specific to themselves: room, board, travel. The ski team will try to do more and more in terms of wax technicians, coaches, support providers, whether that's doctors, physiologists, sports psychologists, et cetera, vans, gas, all that infrastructure. We're going to camp opportunities. We're going to continue to build that infrastructure around them, but we're going to rely on them to provide some money that goes specifically to them.
It sounded like earlier this spring, USSA considered cutting the Nordic Ski Team's budget. Is there any merit to this? And in fact, will the budget be decreased?
No, I mean, I think there was a period of uncertainty this spring. USSA has a mammoth year in front of them. 30 international events being hosted in the United States of America this year between the different disciplines. And that, of course, includes the 2017 World Junior Championships and U23 Championships at Soldier Hollow and the Utah Olympic Park in Utah. So between that, you know, that event, and there's a ton of Alpine events. I think there's the Aspen World Cup Finals. I believe there's a World Cup in Squaw Valley, and I believe one in Killington, along with the other Beaver Creek, you know, normal fall World Cup, you know, snowboard, freestyle. There's so many events, 30 individual events, that I think the organization is a little bit stretched in terms of trying to do everything. And so we had a period of uncertainty this spring where we weren't really sure if we were going to take a budget cut, if we're going to hold steady, what was going to happen. We're very much going to hold steady and probably have a small increase for cross country going through into this next season, which is great because we want to keep the momentum going.
What is the team's budget?
I don't know. I don't know if I want to comment on that. I think it might be available. I'm not sure, but I'll leave that to the bosses. I'll leave that to the bosses. And I think, you know, one of the challenges is whenever we talk about like specific numbers, you'll never land on a right answer. What will happen is that half of the people will say that's too big of a budget, and half of the people will say that's way too small for a national team to operate on, and nobody will say like that's the right number. You know, what I can tell you is that we are competing against some nations who have budgets that are 10 times bigger than ours. You know, that's really Norway and Russia. You know, all other nations are probably, all other medium-sized nations are probably a little closer to us. Sweden may be a ways away. I imagine we're probably similar with a lot of the Middle European nations. Norway and Russia are a long ways ahead of us. And so that's one of our challenges, is to figure out how do you compete against a nation like a Norway or like a Russia that has so many resources.
How do you foresee a woman stepping into a U.S. ski team coaching role?
We've really talked about this a lot, I'd say over the past 10 to 15 years, in terms of the fact that if you look across the USSA cross-country licensed coaching landscape, there just aren't many women involved in coaching roles. It is a predominantly male-dominated environment at this particular moment. I think the exciting thing is that we have some really talented, hardworking, smart, young female coaches that are coming into the pipeline right now. And we've been really impressed with these women coaches. And I think in the future, you will see a woman in a coaching role with the U.S. ski team. It's probably not that many years away, but I don't know when it's going to be. In the past few years, when we've needed to go and hire a coach, we've specifically targeted athlete or coaches like Jason Cork sitting here, like Brian Fish, who were actually working with some of our key podium potential athletes as club coaches. And those athletes were coming onto the national team program, and we saw immense possibilities for those athletes and wanted to provide a seamless transition for them from the senior club level to the national team. So Jesse Diggins is really a perfect example of that. As Jesse was coming on the team, we're looking for a coach. We liked working with Jason. We were impressed by the work that he had done at his time at CXC. And we said, this is the guy that we really want to bring in. And it's worked out. You know, for Jesse, it was a key strategy to be able to have that continuity of programming, of coaching, and come right from the club level to the national team level and just keep going forward.
Thinking of the skeeters you've had on the team the past few years, you clearly have a core. They've been together for a while now. How do you prevent skeeters from becoming stale?
Oh gosh, it's a really good question. It's one that we're wrestling with right now and dealing with right now. And you know, we got a lot of veterans on the team, as you just suggested. And I think one of the strengths of the U.S. program has been the retention of athletes. If you look at the ranks, within the U.S. ski team and across the board of those who are, you know, national caliber athletes who are perhaps just off the team in terms of their ability at this moment, there's been very few retirements over the last few years. We've ended up with a more veteran and veteran group that is part of the national team. And, you know, we've kind of tackled it a few different ways. One is we're definitely looking for new ways to run training camps. One of the challenges is we keep going back to some of the same locations for training camps. Here we are in Bend, Oregon. It's really hard for us not to go to Bend, Oregon this time of year because there's so few places in the world where you can ski on the regular cross-country ski trails in good snow conditions at this time of year. And we can drive here and we can do it in a low budget kind of way and have a very good camp with lots of on snow time. But how do you keep it fresh? So, you know, we have to look at, you saw us in action coaching the other day, but we have to look at what we're doing each day, what we do within the session, what activities we do outside of the session. But then on top of that, I think we have had to rethink a little bit how we structure the competition season in particular, because, you know, we've had this model as North Americans where the team departs in the middle of November and they come home in middle to late March and they're on the road for 4 months straight. And that can work sometimes for a 22-year-old athlete, but it doesn't necessarily work for a 32-year-old athlete who may be married, who may be wanting to start a family, who may have a serious boyfriend, or girlfriend, who may have a house, you know, that sort of thing. So, you know, we're looking at different models for individuals in terms of, can they take a break and go home? Can they get away from the team and do a camp with a significant other? Can they go visit somebody else during the season? A few years ago, we would have said, you know, before a major championships, we're going to have the whole team in camp in the middle of the season in Europe. This year, our plan is actually to send everybody home before the major championships for several weeks. It'll be a little bit of a test for us, but we want to make this test not on an Olympic year, but the year before and see how it works.
You mean not what they would consider, say, a home base in Europe, but literally, say, back in Vermont?
It's going to be a little bit different for everybody. There will be some athletes who will probably stay in Europe and go someplace with somebody, with their husband or with a boyfriend or girlfriend or with friends to a camp situation. But I think there'll be the majority of athletes who actually will come home to the U.S., reconnect with their community, reconnect with loved ones, friends, and family, and hopefully get a big mental and emotional boost to come back to the World Championships and to finish out the World Cup season. And that's something we haven't been able to do or haven't been willing to do always in the past. But we feel like, given the fact that we have so many veterans and that burnout is a real possibility, emotional, mental burnout, that we need to look for solutions like this. So we're going to give it a shot.
Keegan is obviously not at this camp, and she was absent at least from skiing on the World Cup last season. From an athlete perspective, who is stepping into the leadership role?
Yeah, definitely. I'd say that, you know, for sure, Keegan has been a massive team leader and somebody that the women in particular look to for mentorship, for a model of how to train, for a model of professionalism. In her absence last year, and I'd say even before that, actually, for a few years now, you've seen a number of other athletes, men and women on the team, really step into leadership positions. You know, a veteran like Andy Newell on the guy's side has absolutely been in that position. Sammy Hamilton, you know, has a lot of leadership skills himself. On the guy's side, those two probably in particular. On the women's side, I'd say, man, you know, Sadie Bjornsson, Liz Steven, Sophie Caldwell, there's just been a number of these guys that have been on the World Cup long enough that they are really able to take leadership positions. So I don't think there's been any sort of, you know, lack of team leaders. At the same time, I'm not sure that we always, that each team really requires a leader per se in order to gel. I think they do a great job of just looking out for each other and helping each other and taking care of each other. And when somebody's down, walking over and giving people hugs. And, you know, so it's, Yeah, I don't think there's one person that you can really put your finger on.
What are some of your biggest challenges as head coach?
The challenges that I have are probably the challenges that the program have and that U.S. skiing has, U.S. cross-country skiing has at the moment. One is the cost of doing business on the World Cup. And that's something that we're working on at the FIS level right now as well. But the big challenge is for a nation that's kind of, say, a middle-sized or mid-sized cross-country skiing nation in the scheme of the World Cup, along with a lot of other nations, there's such a massive percentage of our annual budget that is having to go towards the World Cup in order to compete there. We talked a little bit earlier about needing a physical therapist for the entire World Cup season and needing to have enough wax technicians to compete with the big nations and putting a wax truck in place and putting coaching in place and doctors and nutritionists and sports psychologists and the amount of money that we are having to spend on wax. And then you add vans and gas and all the other elements of the infrastructure. And it becomes by far the lion's share of our budget has to go to the World Cup merely to be able to compete. You can't cut down that number. You can't reduce that number without greatly reducing the potential for good results on a given day. When so much money goes to the top end, it leaves very little for development, and it leaves very little for the future, at least from the national team level. And so what happens is we end up relying on all the clubs to step up and try to fill that gap. And that puts a lot of financial pressure on all of these clubs, especially when it comes to senior skiing, especially when it comes to athletes that are post-high school and post-college. Because for clubs, as you know, that is a money-losing proposition to fund those kinds of teams. You're talking about athletes who are no longer at home, their parents are no longer paying the bills, but they don't have any money themselves. Their expenses are high. Their needs for coaching and for travel and equipment and waxing, you know, there's a lot of expense there. So that really puts a lot of pressure on the clubs to really provide that key part of our development pipeline to bring more athletes to the top who can then go on to join World Cup teams, World Championship teams, Olympic teams. So I'd say that's one of the biggest challenges, and is trying to figure out how to support the next level that's below the World Cup group. The other part of my challenge is how to compete with a country like Norway or a country like Russia that does have a budget that is perhaps 10 times bigger than ours. And how do we really compete with them? And it's a work in progress. Work in progress on both fronts right now. Going to be working on that for a while.
What is a recent moment of excellence?
That's a good question. I mean, we were, as a World Cup team and as a staff, we were very proud of the accomplishments of the athletes and really proud of the way that the staff worked this past winter and all those people who were associated with our staff. I mean, we have many people on our staff that are paid coaches or they are paid contract servicemen for the wintertime, but we also rely on many volunteers, volunteer wax technicians at times, volunteer docs, volunteer physiotherapists, massage therapists. And as you know, everywhere that we go to do a preparation camp, we incorporate even more volunteers because we have resources within communities where these providers and communities step up and help us out. And it's an absolute difference maker for us. I guess I'm getting a little bit off track. We were really proud of the effort of the athletes, and I'll say the team, and by team I mean everybody who was associated with the effort this past winter. I think one of the things that we took some pride from during the season was that we had success in some of the places where we really tried to have success, where we really targeted Of course, we had a winter where there was no major championships. And so we took a look at the calendar, and as a group, we talked last year when we had this camp. Actually, it wasn't in Bend, it was in Park City at this time. But we sat down as a group and we talked about some of the places where strategically we wanted to be successful. The Tour de Ski was one of those. We knew it was going to be probably the premier race series or focal point of the year. And of course, you know, we had Jesse and Sophie both win their first World Cups in the Tour de Ski. We wanted to be successful in Novo Mesto in particular, especially with our women's group, because we saw that there was going to be a 10K individual skate, which we know is one of our better events, plus a relay. And so we targeted those two events. And of course, we were able to get on the podium both days. And then, of course, we really wanted to take advantage of the Canadian tour in particular, because we knew there'd be a lot of American fans there. It gave us a semi-home course advantage feeling. We knew we could be at home a few days longer and perhaps than our European counterparts and perhaps acclimate a little bit better. So to start the tour with the double podium in Gatineau was fantastic. Unfortunately, we had some illness run through the team after that, which sidelined us a bit. But anyway, you know, I think that was a source of pride for us, where as a program, we took a look at events that we could target and wanted to be successful at, and were actually able to deliver at those times in particular.
If we were sitting here a year from now, what would you have accomplished?
Well, hopefully one of our goals as a program is to have two medals at the Lahti World Championship. And that's obviously like our biggest goal of the season. So I'm hoping that we are sitting here and we have two medals or maybe even more. But that's kind of what we're going for, and we're putting it out there as a program that this is our goal, and we think it's achievable if we do everything right, if we pull everybody together and we deliver really good support to these athletes, and we make great skis for these athletes, and we help these guys be healthy and rested and ready to go. We think that's achievable. A year from now, we want to have a very solid plan in place for the PyeongChang Olympics. I've been there once already, but I've been there in the summertime, so I have a little bit of the lay of the land, but I don't have a great understanding of what it's going to look like. We will be there this winter, and we are going to do a lot of testing and a lot of looking around, and we need to figure out exactly what we're doing for lodging, exactly what we're doing for food, how we're going to keep the team healthy during the Olympics, which is a massive challenge, probably the biggest hurdle that we're going to have to overcome. And
more so there than anywhere.
No, it's just it's a specific challenge to the Olympics, simply because you have so many athletes and so many technicians and so many people around. It's really challenging to keep healthy. And the last two games, we haven't managed to keep everyone healthy. But at the same time, when you are talking about a team that's the size of our team, that may be 30 persons between athletes and staff, chances are people are going to actually get sick, especially when they're racing that hard or working that hard. But obviously, illness can derail everything that we're trying to achieve. So that's going to be one of the big things to try to figure out: what's the best living situation, what's the best meal situation, transport for the USA. How are we going to approach ski service and testing and grinding and all that sort of thing there? So we have some big things to figure out within the next year. So when I'm sitting here next year, hopefully I have a much, much better idea of exactly what our plan's going to look like. I would say also next year when we're sitting here, I'd really like to be able to, for all of us to point with pride at some results from the World Junior and U23 World Championships in Utah. I think we have a absolutely unique opportunity this year to have the world come to us and to be able to compete on a course that we're going to be racing on at U.S. Nationals, selecting teams at U.S. Nationals. We also have some athletes who are ranked among the best juniors in the world going into this championship. So I'm really hoping that we have some big, big results that we can look back at as a community with pride.
How do you clean up the sport?
First of all, you got to back up and say the sport is not dirty per se. The vast majority of nations that are competing are doing it 100% clean. And I think when you look at Norway, for example, here's a nation that is absolutely dominating the sport. And I'm quite certain that they're doing it 100% clean. It's part of their national ethics. So when you see that, you know that people win every day in cross-country skiing that are doing it clean. On top of that, we've had multiple USA athletes that have won World Cups or a World Championship event, and they're doing it 100% clean. So it absolutely can be done. But you're right, at the edge of the sport, there is cheating. And I would invite all parties that have any sort of role in governance of the sport to look for ways to increase testing inside competition, but more importantly, outside of competition. And I know that becomes an incredible financial challenge. It's a challenge for many nations, and it's a challenge for the organizations that are in charge of protecting sport and making sure that it's clean. But it's really critical, and it's going to have an impact on the advertising dollars that a given sport can bring in, or a given sport governance organization. So increased testing, I know as a nation, USA really invites that. You know, we invite as much testing on USA athletes as is possible. Inside competition, outside of competition, camp environments, home environments, you know, are at the USA athletes, they are registering their whereabouts with USADA every day of the year and every hour of the day. So bring on the testing. We will, you know, it's really important for us that we do have a level playing field and that we do have a clean sport, because when we have that situation, USA athletes have been able to shine and will shine in the future. So bring it on.
Thoughts on the recent doping allegations involving the Russians?
You know, for us, it's important right now that we don't just single out any particular nation in this process, but really ask that all leads are investigated. And I think, as I mentioned when I talked to Chelsea, I think the other day, we really invite all media scrutiny of the sport whenever possible, because I think there's some really good work that's being done by various media sources around the world right now in terms of asking the hard questions and doing the investigative work that's really critical. And so I think that's a critical component. At this point, you know, I think it's important that we just ask for increased scrutiny, increased testing, and if there is the suspicion of wrongdoing, that there's investigations.
U.S. men's skiing, at the national level, how are you, USSA, the ski team, how are you trying to get on track or on par with the women's success?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, the men are in a little bit of an unfortunate situation because they actually are always being compared to the ladies. There's some challenges and some hurdles in that situation. First off, I'd say if you look at any mid-sized to even bigger, some of the bigger ski nations, there's always an imbalance between the success that, say, the women's group is having versus the success that the men's group is having. You've seen that in Switzerland in recent years. You've seen it in Canada in recent years. You see it in France in a major way right now with a really successful men's program, but really struggling to gain traction, I guess I would say, on the ladies' side. With the exception of the strongest nation like Norway, which is really equally strong in both men and women, that it's probably kind of a normal side of sport to have groups of athletes come through at times and be able to push each other's success. We talked about this at Congress last week. If you go back in U.S. skiing history to the early 2000s, what you see is a very strong men's group and almost no women's group at all, actually. And that just had to do with the strength of the peer group. So occasionally you get a strong group of athletes that come through that are all within, say, 5-6 years of age of each other. You get them into a training situation, they begin to push each other and get stronger and stronger, and then you end up with a strong group on one side. But it may not be happening with the other sex simultaneously. In fact, it'd be rare for it to actually happen simultaneously. So I think it's a little bit of nature, a little bit of the nature of ski sport. At the same time, you also see a ton of depth on the men's side in the World Cup, in that within the same 30 seconds back in a race, there are many more men stacked in there. So what occasionally looks like a medium performance by a man would actually be an outstanding performance by a woman. And it's not unusual for occasionally the best fist point race of the day to go to one of the men. But there's so much depth in that field ahead of them that they end up overshadowed by the performance of the ladies. So we will be successful. There will be times in the near future where we have a very strong men's group and not a strong women's group. And I think that's a little bit the cyclical nature of the sport.
Do you guys ever look at, say, in terms of funding and how you are promoting men onto the U.S. ski team? Are things like depth of field considered?
You know, we do absolutely. We do look at field depths in terms of like judging perhaps where somebody is in their development or what their future potential might be. One of the challenges is at the end of the day, there's only three places on the podium. So if a programmatic goal is to have medals at the World Championships, or if it is to have medals at the Olympic Winter Games, then at the end of the day, we need to be targeting the athletes that we think can actually have those types of results, no matter how much field depth there is or isn't in a current situation. Our selection this year to the BND teams is really no different than it's ever has been. Almost across the board, every year, those positions are almost 100% discretionary. There have been exceptions to that. Last year, we had Caitlin Gregg as a B-team athlete, and she actually made the objective criteria via having low enough fist points. Several years ago, we had Noah Hoffman on the B-team, and he made the criteria after having a second place at the U23 World Championships. So if we have an athlete, for example, who has a podium at World Juniors or U23s, they are automatically going to be named to the team. But beyond that, we don't have specific criteria for the B team and the D team. And I think, as I mentioned, perhaps in that article, it is really challenging to dream up any sort of criteria that captures the right athletes at that time and doesn't end up capturing athletes kind of for the wrong reasons, perhaps. And the reason is that fist points in the U.S. don't line up with fist points in Europe. And results on the Super Tour don't always line up with results on Europa Cup or Scandinavian Cup. And you have athletes racing in so many different venues around the world and at different levels of competition that it's very hard to compare athletes. I mean, how somebody does at world, comparing one athlete from World Junior Championships or U23 World Championships versus a result on Scandinavian Cup versus result at Super Tour or at NCAA Championships is really, really impossible. So we just need to look for kind of those standout results that that individual athletes have. And in particular, we tend to really want to see some results in Europe against European fields that demonstrate that a given athlete has the ability to go to Europe against a strong field and post a standout result. And typically that is indicative of being able to do that at a World Cup, World Championship, or Olympic level.